One of the really interesting thing Bob Thurman likes to say about the tantras is that they're a technology for accelerating your evolution in a conscious way. And how he describes that is that you sort of learn how to, in tantric practice, you learn how to consciously die and be reborn many times a day. And you know, you're trying to, as you dissolve your sense of self and you recreate your sense of self, every time you get a new take to upgrade your identity, your relationship with reality. So that's how he explains how the tantric practice is of embodied compassion is so much quicker than the regular practice, is that it's as if we're compressing many, many lifetimes into one. But to be technical, one of the definitions of the creation stage, when we use imagery, is that we are transforming our death experience into a path to embodying the truth. We're transforming our afterlife or our development after death, after we experience a kind of simulated death, into a path to experiencing bliss and beauty. And we're transforming our returning to awakening consciousness or life as a path to embodying, to emanating enlightenment, right? So the idea is that this notion of deconstructing and reconstructing the self is really already traditionally central to the what we're trying to do with the creative imagination practice. And what happens when we move into the perfection stage is that we actually, in addition to sort of simulating death by melting into light and then you know, reinventing ourselves up out of light, right? Or melting into the void and reimagining ourselves out of the void. We actually try to simulate the death experience by inducing altered states. And this is where the non-dual state comes in, is that you're essentially trying to kind of have a near-death experience or have a conscious experience of going into deep sleep, right? And in so doing, you're kind of getting the hang of how to die. And then when you emerge from that, you're kind of getting and this is like a chemical transformation, because you're learning, your nervous system is learning to consciously dissolve or die. And then your nervous system has to practice learning how to consciously be reborn, resurrect itself, or reemerge. And then you kind of learn how to be, which is like a practicing lucid dreaming, right? It's like you're emerging into a life as a lucid dream. And then you're learning how to live the waking state as a path to just manifesting, emanating, awakening as an embodied awakened being. So anyway, that's something that I loved your questions, and that's something that you know, kind of central. I mean, it's a very traditional rubric or way of understanding what the creation stage and perfection stage, what tantric practice is really about. So this notion, even though Zoran was importing Western terminology and theorists, actually this notion of, you know, reinventing yourself in, you know, in the way you perceive reality and in the way you chemically embody is really traditionally the way that this practice is thought of. So that's cool, right? And hopefully we'll get, you know, I mean, we'll come back to this and break it down into steps and so on. But I just wanted to share that with you. Today, this evening, we're going to try to get a little more practical, if it's possible. And I wanted to share with you just some of my thoughts about how I practice and how I see my compassion. Maybe the sound will be better if I put your pods on. You can tell me if
that's true. Okay.
Can you speak a little, Joe?
Okay, so is that better?
Actually, yes.
Okay, good. That's what they say. So let's hope they last. I just wanted to give you a sense of how I experience the relationship between my practice, compassion practice, and my therapy, and maybe to just tell you about two cases that just current things that recently happened in one individual and one couple, to give you a flavor for, how I approach, how I rely on these practices to help me kind of get through the session and get through to others. So I'm going to share just a few slides, just because I think it will save us some words. Okay. And so basically I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to review elements of compassion practice. So this should all feel like review for all of you. And then I'm going to talk about how I think about how that applies to individual therapy. And then I'm going to look at two case studies. And then I'm going to look at how I, actually, I'm sorry, this is, I'm going to do it slightly differently. I'm going to do the application to individual psychotherapy and the application to couples therapy, and then I'm going to close with the two case presentations. Okay, so, all right. So here's, this is a system, some of you may be familiar with this from, if you've done CBRT, looking at compassion as something that has different levels, right? Our whole mind and body can be in compassion mode or in stress mode, right? Just think social connection or self-involvement and self-protection. And so on the sort of level of our waking perceptions, what is it? What is compassion as a way of perceiving the world? It's having unbiased empathy for other people suffering, right? So that as Losung Rauke was sharing with us, it's really recognizing what's going on inside the other person, not our projection of it. But then what's next in the process? Well, do we care? Does it matter to us? Are we participants? Do we feeling like drawn toward this in a kind of as part of a response of concern? And that's what I would like to call empathic concern, or a felt sense that, I care about what you're feeling. I understand what you're feeling, but I also care about it. It matters to me. It's important. I'm present for it. Then, what's the next sort of level of the response? The compassionate response is what I might call, embodied compassion. That is, I start to feel ready to an urge or an impulse, an intention to respond, to reach out, to relieve the suffering, right? So it's that motivation, that starting to move, or intentionality in the direction of relief. And then the last level is there's an action that is informed by the correct perception, is informed by caring, is informed by a wish to help, a response, a constructive response. Because it's informed by all of those things, it's effective in relieving the suffering. So how does this apply to practice the sort of basic, stuff that we need if we're practicing therapy, right? So what might be the blocks to being able to embody compassion in the presence of others? well, their distress triggers my distress, or I'm so worried I have to fix it, right? I can't tolerate being around the suffering. And it stirs up all kinds of reactivity for me. That's the second level. The third level is I really, because I'm emotionally activated, I have all kinds of, counter-transferential biases. And it triggers goes to the bottom of my sense of self and triggers some sense of inadequacy or unsafety or whatever. On an embodied level, I might even start to get physically activated, aroused, anxious. Okay, so here's like the social stress response that we can often have in a difficult interaction are the obstacles that we have to deal with in staying present with others in therapy. So what would be the qualities we're trying to cultivate based on our compassion practice is this kind of radical optimism, like really understanding that, the other person is not their suffering, that they're just a awesome, multi-potential, infinite being who happens to be suffering, right? So not labeling, I'll talk about this a little later. And then the fundamental trust and self-confidence in the other, in ourselves, and in the process that actually we're gonna get somewhere. Suffering is temporary, that it can be relieved. And with that in the moment, what that means is being able to tolerate the vulnerability of caring about this other person's suffering, sharing it with them, and being able to stay in a place of concern through a kind of equanimity. That is a kind of ability to not react, but bear with the tides of affect, whether it's, they're feeling good, they're feeling bad. And how do we do that over the long haul is we have to really have a deep sense of common humanity rather than a sense of I'm different, like you're suffering, I'm not. And draw from our own humanity and our own suffering, which involves this radical acceptance of the human condition and the humility that we're all just really bozos on the bus in some way, as well as, finally, on the level of our deepest embodiment, a kind of willingness to be present and try to, stay tuned to, or to use Stephen's term, co-regulate with where the other person is at. So how does this pan out in terms of my philosophy or approach to therapy? Well, one thing is I never diagnose. I do not like diagnoses. I think that they're just a waste of mental energy and harmful in terms of biasing our own perception of the other person and also potentially biasing their perception of themselves. Obviously you need to write a diagnosis in order to get billing reimbursement, but I don't share it unless people force me to. And frankly, I don't really, spend too much time worrying about if it's the right diagnosis. over time, think about, try to understand what is this person's unique form of suffering. But again, I think that that's very different. Maybe you could think of that more as psychological formulation. Also key is important from my point as another piece of this is to really not see the relationship as a psychotherapy. I mean, honestly, I try not to see myself, as the therapist in the room, as opposed to just being another, bozo on the bus, another person who happens to be listening today. And I think it's really important that we really develop the capacity to deconstruct the professionalization and the power structures and social role control structures that are part of that, right? There's so many ways in which therapy can be an oppressive potentially harmful context. So it's really important to get back down to the basics, which is, in my view, for some reason, we're lucky enough to spend time just talking about life together and sharing a conversation about how life is going. So to me, that's kind of like, what I feel I'm doing. I think it's important not to distance yourself or avoid the real relationship with the person you're talking to, the people we call our clients as, or the people we call our patients, as one of my supervisors used to say. And that means a shared vulnerability, right? It means really understanding that this is a real relationship. I do have feelings. I am human. You're human too. As well as a kind of, within that, a deeper sense of humility in the sense of willingness to be in relationship. And that means to be changed by the relationship, to unlearn some things and to learn others. And then as part of that, being in the relationship and being willing to learn from it or be changed by it, there's hanging in there through the whole shebang of it, even when it starts to feel like it's going off the rails. So I think that some of the practices that we've touched on in the fall really help me maintain this sense, like being able to see through the social construction or my perceptual construction of myself as a professional, and the other person as my client, or as myself as the helper and the other person as the helpee or whatever, and really being able to see the relativity of that and the uniqueness of the person and the interaction and even of who I am in that moment with that person. And I think it's important in terms of being able to show up with, shared vulnerability to have a capacity to really fundamentally accept yourself and all living beings wherever we are with equanimity, and to know how incredibly difficult life can just be and how much suffering is involved in everything, as we learn. I think in terms of the willingness to relate and unlearn, there's a kind of opening of the mind and heart and energy that's necessary. And I think that the spacious intuitive wisdom, the wisdom that, we talk about openness or emptiness, that's also key training for that capacity. And then really learning to grow into the spirit of altruism or the enjoying being helpful, really enjoying being a companion on somebody's journey, even if we can't help very much, helping them share the burden. That's the kind of altruism, the bodhicitta practice, and how that does it. So, and I'll just say finally, in discussing this, affirming, how do we work out, how do we de-stigmatize or de-medicalize or de-pathologize the discourse of therapy what's really important for me is to try to keep updating the story that I have of why the client is there, what their deeper purpose is and their deeper transformational potential and purpose in being there, and to really keep trying to help them do the same, to sort of keep growing this sense of, I'm not here because I'm broken, I need to be fixed, but I have the courage to face myself, my experience, my demons, and heal. I think in terms of not distancing, it's important that we stay emotionally present and accountable. That means we have to be accountable. If we're not sitting behind the couch like Freud and we're making ourselves open in this way, we might, as you'll see in one of my cases, we might end up getting annoyed or pissed off and having the other person know that and having to be accountable and transparent about what's going on for us. Likewise, we need to be capable of this kind of deep listening and openness, and also of a kind of being in a conversation that's larger than either person's internal narrative, you know. And I think Pilar will come back to talking about this. And finally, then, to have the larger work be to sort of understand what we're doing within the largest possible context of not just sort of trying to, you know, reduce mental suffering, but to really help promote, you know, a greater awakening on the part of our individuals and the people around them, the people whose lives they touch. So I think, yeah, so that's my take on some principles of individual compassion-based therapy. I don't know if I can go backwards here. Can I? Oh, I can. Well, how do you like that? I can stop for a minute if people wanna comment on anything, or I can go back as well if people have any thoughts about any of that. How does that sound? I don't know why I'm... Yeah, hold on a second. I'm not sure why I'm not... Okay. Yes, please.
So I just wonder how you hold, and maybe, I mean, I'm so just for like disclosure for context for why I'm asking this, just as I'm a midwife, I'm a nurse midwife, so, you know, and part of the reason that I'm very interested in perinatal wellness, mental health. I'm not going to go on too long of a like diatribe about this, but I do feel like the terms like postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, like they just don't hold what a lot of women experience. Anyways, but I also at the same time I also feel very much like normalizing that experience, and part of that is like naming it and destigmatizing it. And so there's like some tension, like both like when I hear you say that you don't like diagnoses, I'm like, oh my God, yes, yes. And then there's another part of me that's like, well, how do we destigmatize those that have a diagnosis, or like, how do we hold that? Or if people need medication, like how do we hold those things in a way that feels both to ourselves and to our clients? Or I love what you said, the people I call my patients, I love that. Like, how do we hold those things? How do you experience that?
Yeah, I think it really is, I think you're right that it can be, we can have a stance of just, you know, denying that people have suffering and acting like everybody's, you know, just a little distressed somehow, but clearly that isn't this, you know, we all at different points in life and some more than others really are burdened with extraordinary kinds of suffering. And I think the way I tend to approach that is to put it in the context of a narrative. Like, in other words, you know, just to understand you really are suffering, that you're not making this up. This isn't necessarily what what anybody might feel, you know, this is, and here's how I see, you know, like when I talk about people, a lot of people who have childhood trauma have learned to minimize it or compartmentalize it, for example. Or, you know, a lot of people who are self-attacking have learned to normalize it. And I think at times it really is important to shine the light on it and say, this is suffering. This really is hard. This is awful. But it doesn't necessarily require a diagnosis to do that, right? And because there's so many ways you can help a person, you know, face and understand. The problem I have with the diagnosis is it's locked into this whole sick care, you know, and I'm going to take over and fix this for you mentality, which is not really designed to help educate a person about what is really going on in their minds and bodies and what they can do about it. So it's disempowering, it's stigmatizing, it's blaming, but I totally agree, and you're absolutely right, that we don't want to minimize and whitewash or whatever, you know, gloss over what people are actually suffering, and even when it is, you know, extreme, and when it may be some of the most extreme suffering. So I hope that helps.
That's helpful. Hearing a narrative is helpful. And then I just want to make a comment, which is that, like, when you were speaking, you know, again, from the perspective of a midwife, there's a way in which I'm like, this is psychological midwifery. Like, when you're at your midwifery best, you are like holding space for a process to unfold. And then if it unfolds in a way that might create harm, like you gently steer it, and sometimes not so gently steer it where it needs to go. But anyways, a lot of the verbiage that you're using, it really feels on the same wavelength, which I think makes sense, because a lot of midwifery and birth and like this world is around intuition.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. I love that, you know, psychological midwifery. I'll have to take that as a new way of thinking about what I do, and what we all do. And the whole issue is that, remember what Dr. Nita said about how Tantra is part of our nature. We have the capacity to transform suffering. Our bodies naturally heal. I mean, obviously childbirth is a natural process. It's the natural process that got us all here. And to medicalize these and try to control them and mechanically, this is some kind of weird, distorted excuse for healing, you know? And it can be very harmful. There's so many reasons why, you know, that is a process that should make us feel violated, because it's again part of, it's part of a fear-based control system that's trying to control suffering, and it's, you know, waging war on suffering instead of learning how to welcome it and learn from it or work with it as part of the natural process of healing. So yeah, I think that's, you know, I can see we're on the same wavelength there. And that's part of the reason why, for me, like, I really related to what Cecil Paul said about how when somebody comes to see him, he doesn't know whether they're coming to see a Zen teacher or a therapist. And while I don't necessarily, I'm not a seso or something like that, or a lama or something like that, but I do feel like I really want to know what a person wants from me, and respect that it's really up to, as this is how the Buddha taught, you know, the healing starts from the client or the person, you know, the person who's suffering. Like, where are you suffering? How are you suffering? That's where it starts from. And in Tibetan medicine, for example, one of the first qualification for being a Tibetan doctor, does anybody want to guess? Is it getting a high score on your GREs? No.
Philip. Philip has something to say.
Philip, yes.
Man. It used to be being...
Pardon me? Male. I'm sorry?
I said it used to be being male until recently, right?
Perhaps, but that's certainly not the first qualification. No, the first qualification is compassion, you know, yeah. So one has to have the, you know, the compassionate motivation. Otherwise, don't bother applying, right? So imagine if we did that. And again, I do think a lot of people that apply that go to become health providers and mental health providers have compassion as their motivation, only does it really survive the training, quote unquote, you know? And or is it drummed out of you? And are you, you know, somehow frightened into thinking compassion is going to hurt you or hurt the other person? So, you know, this is really a big concern.
And in so much of mental health training, we don't even use the word compassion when we're training people.
It's not only do we not use we don't use the word, and let alone there being any kind of training in compassion, even though all the research shows that rapport and communication and all these things are really not just important in therapy, but they're important even physical medicine or healthcare. But yeah, I mean, I work at a hospital where we have a culture of compassion, but nobody ever, you know, nobody has a clue what it really, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are very compassionate, but there's no definition, there's no training, there's no rigor around it. There's no commitment. It's just words.
We also don't talk about suffering.
Exactly. We don't do suffering. We do diagnosis and treatment. So it's all really an attempt, I think, to kind of, you know, wage war on, suppress, control, and all break into bits and destroy an important part of our reality and our nature. And hence you can see the harm done. So yeah. Okay, so this is a different way. And maybe what I'll do is go touch on briefly, if there are no other comments just yet, I'll touch briefly on the second, the couples, my sort of approach to couples work. Is that gonna be too much right now? I can do an individual case. Maybe that's the thing, is maybe I'll do the case, the individual case, and then I'll come back to the couple's theory, and then we'll do the couple's case after that. How's that? Okay. So I'm going to share with you a case of a divorced single mother who, you know, was an entrepreneur and came to me when her son graduated from college, sort of at a loss. She had sort of begun to have a kind of mental breakdown, quote unquote, whatever, be unable to work, and or she came to her senses and decided she didn't want to work anymore because she'd been working in these high pressure, high profile nonprofit, you know, large nonprofit organizations. She's the child of a narcissistic mom who was like kind of a picker up, pick herself up for bootstraps type of woman who became very successful and a sexually intrusive stepfather. So just to give you an example, the mother would slam the door and lock it whenever she didn't like something that my client said and wouldn't speak to her for hours or days. And really obviously traumatizing my client. The stepfather would, on his way to the pool, would come and lie in the client's bed naked, you know, or with a towel on or something. And the mother never really seemed to pick up on that. And, you know, so again, maybe no surprise, she wound up getting involved in a lot of co-narcissistic relationships in which she became codependent with narcissistic people, and mostly men, although some women as well, and both at work. So she would become the second in command and really make everything happen. She had a number of affairs with super, super powerful men who, you know, were older, most of them. And so, you know, you can see the kind of pattern, patterning there. So when she came to me, what she was struggling with was kind of like this dissociative oscillation between a kind of what I would call a false narcissistic, very cognitive and idealized self, right? That is the part of her that was super brilliant, could do anything, could solve anything, was her mother's golden girl sort of thing. And a kind of very regressed, avoidant, emotionally sensitive, but traumatized self-state where she sort of became like a girl who couldn't even go out of the apartment. And so really I've been working with her for, I think, around 7 years now, and this is not unusual. For my practice anyway, and a lot of that time she's spent oscillating between these two states, right? Where she, when she kind of gets, and you can see, maybe you can think of this, you could think about many diagnoses where this would be, that would come to mind. But, you know, essentially she would start, you know, she would kind of rev up and start a new project, a new life that she wanted to start because she felt lost otherwise. And then after a certain amount of time, she would run into emotionally charged experience and then crash. And one of the things she started to do when she got sick of trying to start new businesses that she pulled out of and that crashed, she started applying to become a psychoanalyst. And so she, I guess in the course of the next few years, she applied to and withdrew from about 4 different psychoanalytic institutes. And this was torture for her. I mean, like, she got really, really excited. She was passionate about reading psychoanalytic literature. And, you know, she's clearly a caregiver. She did a beautiful job raising her one son. This would be a way that we thought she could stay connected to her emotional self while also connecting to the world, but it didn't work. My mission was to try to sort of, essentially I was having a conversation with 2 people, you know, with 2 self states, and trying to really allow the conversation with both. Essentially there was kind of a revolving door. So where I want to focus in this one particular encounter was the last institute she applied to. She had asked me to become the training analyst for her, which would mean I would need to open another session. She was my lowest fee client, and she'd need another session. So I turned my schedule a little bit upside down to make that available to her. And then when she withdrew, I said, well, look, I had to turn my schedule upside down to do this. I don't think I can actually follow through with this. And as long as you don't need a supervision hour, you know, we can continue with our therapy. And she felt deeply wounded and abandoned. And this was, she felt essentially that I was angry and punishing her. So the remainder of what I'm going to just read to you texts, because I don't know whether this is, you know, I supplement my sessions communicating with people by text when they feel a need to do that. And so it's an easy way to, you can hear her in her own words and you can hear me in my own words. The first text after that session. You are really checked out on me, Joe. Not responding to an emotionally laden text for 24 hours until my prompting, then having me wait 6 more days to deal with it. This is a pattern in our therapy. When I'm in your good graces, you're responsive, and when I'm not, you're not. Instead of responding that this is an interpretation, that this is really about my mother, a transference, please sincerely consider your own countertransference with me, because she's now a psychoanalytic candidate. You have a lot of anger with me, Joe, and I suspect that this text is going to anger you more. But if we're really going to get at the feelings you're always prompting me for, we need to deal with this head on, human to human. So you can see that she's psychoanalyzing me. But of course, I was in fact mad at her, right? Not so much because she had pulled out, because I really felt, you know, I really felt for her the trauma that she went through about trying to get started again and then being overwhelmed, and but just because of the level of entitlement and the devaluation or shame rage or whatever she was directing at me, which obviously she could never direct at mother or the other people, was triggering for me personally, like, you know, by triggering my own inner critic. So I was able to sort of admit that I was angry, although it wasn't because of what she thought, and I wasn't trying to punish her, but you know, that I felt a little hurt by the way she spoke to me, so we were able to sort of piece it together that we were going through this reenactment where she was trying to kind of, you know, please me as mother by becoming like me, like becoming an analyst or a therapist, but then feeling compelled to pull out and test me to see if I really, you know, if I was really unconditionally loving and accepting of her. So we sort of were able to see that this was, a reenactment. And I think that sort of, piecing together both of us in that session really seemed to open the floodgates, and something fundamentally shifted in the session. I mean, even though, again, it seems, I really believe that change happens very organically. I mean, it's not like delivering a child, because you know pretty much within 9 months you're going to get something. And I feel like in my experience in therapy, you could be on a plateau for years and you may not get to a breakthrough point. But clearly we got, after however many years we got to one, and she started to tell me about secrets about herself, sort of shameful secrets or secrets that she was embarrassed about that she had never shared with me, and started to talk about how, you know, fundamentally she felt accepted in a way she'd never felt before. So, thank you. Now we go to from the devaluation to the idealization. So thank you. I felt so much better since our exchange. I was earlier thinking in the kitchen, does Joe know how much he means to me and how much I love him as a human being? In much the same way I was thinking, asking that question of my son and a few days ago. I feel deeply seen and known by you, and there's no greater gift. I don't know how I will ever be able to give you what you have given me. Please know at the core of your being how grateful I am, and so on. This is part of her sort of, we've talked about this, and her need to, it's a security operation to kind of, appease mother's narcissism, in this case, mine. Although I do think that she has genuine feelings of gratitude, but apart from that, so the whole process of the accelerating of her therapy got further accelerated because her son decided he was finally going to really move out and starting a new job in California, took all his things, which he'd never done before, and really said, I really need my space, Mom. He's in his, I think, late 20s at this point. And her dog, who was a beloved companion for 10 years, died. So she had these two very powerful losses. And she says to me in another text, "Hi, Joe, I'm really struggling. I find myself falling into tears in the last 2 days, less about my dog and son, and more about the shell of a person I feel in my apartment alone. I can't seem to hold onto oneself before another reverses that hold. And I cry as I feel one slipping away right in the moment. I'm just paralyzed and suspended between the two selves and ways of being in the world. Without the distractions and dependencies of my past, I can't seem to find a center. I'm so deeply sad, but strangely not depressed, for at least I'm aware and feeling this." My instinct is just to surrender this and to try not to do anything. Am I okay? Sometimes I wonder. And so I share with her, I'm sorry you're struggling. It's not, that your son's leaving and the dog's death is only really stirring up your abandonment by your mother. I'm just sort of telescoping this. And the fact that you're feeling it is a great gift. Even though your past has been divided, this kind of awareness can allow you to have a whole self. And she's grateful to that. And we go on with some other things. But I just want to share one other kind of piece to this, which is, I think, probably kind of the kind of prize or the gift that came out of this watershed, which is she was able to really start to tap into the feelings of shame and abandonment that she was feeling, that she felt as a girl, I think both because of her mother's emotional disconnection and also because of the sexual whatever intrusion, abuse wasn't, whatever it was. So she says, "Joe, something is coming out of me, filthy, wretched, and disgusting, vile and bile. I feel disgusting, like I'm going to vomit, shame, humiliation, disgust. I saw the false self in its most despicable form. Something clearly happened with my stepfather. I have no memory of anything, but I can feel something. Now I have to face that. this is palpable and a crack opened through this, and I now have the courage to look inside. So I talked to her about this shame as the intergenerational legacy from her mom, right? Because her mom was also trying to get out of her mother's position of being really abused and neglected, stuck in the small town and the brunt of her grandfather, my client's grandfather. It's really extremely helpful to try to feel as much as you can bear. And the key is to not to buy into it, but to know that it's just deep hurt and a letdown from, being unloved or unseen. And the dissociation that you struggle with is precisely from those feelings of shame that feel so lethal, right? So feeling these is indispensable to healing. And she sort of affirms that. She says in response to me, I now understand, actually am now feeling that connection with my mom's shame and not trying to narrate or push it away. Thank you for that, right? So, powerful, and it all comes out of really a very human interaction where, she felt hurt and angry at me, and I felt, annoyed and angry at her, and we just were able to have an open conversation about it. But somehow that was something that she could never have with her mom. Her mom could never be accountable and could never really give her the sense that, she could trust my client to be with her feelings and this kind of mutually vulnerable, open, transparent relationship. So I don't know if there are thoughts about that. I wanted to touch on the couple's piece as well, but I want to give us all time to sort of whatever reflect and digest in whatever way.
Can I ask a question, Joe?
Yeah.
Are there any dots you can connect from that story to how you were saying that you bring the practice into your work?
Yeah, I think in terms of, being willing to go, to hang in there through, I know that most of my colleagues would have years ago, diagnosed her as having rapid cycling bipolar disorder and put her on medication, which we discussed. It's not like I didn't let her know that that was an option. But what I said is you can either kind of fix yourself up, you can get patched up, or you can go through this process and try to get to the bottom of it and really heal and become whole. And yeah, this has been, it's been a long process for her of sort of being able to connect the part of her that can be so, So part of that is really just being willing to bear with all of the suffering of her life and all the seeming dysfunction and to trust that it was actually part of the necessary path that she needed to take to get to the bottom of her suffering and to put the pieces of herself back together again. And to sort of be, her partner on that journey, and just not have to try to control her experience or name it or whatever, but to kind of be able to roll with the punches, and try to, be as, transparent in helping her process what was coming up as possible. So I hope that connects some of the dots.
Well, and if I may, I think the basic, meditation of, the meditating with the thing that you're attracted to, the neutral thing and the thing that you dislike it's like in the session, you're employing those skills with her because things come up that are unpleasant and you're mentoring a response that's feeling all the things and a real human being and acknowledging your own experience in the situation, but modeling for her in a deeply intimate way where she can be very vulnerable. You know, kind of a loving, compassionate adult that perhaps she didn't have when she was younger. And it's allowing her nervous system to feel a sense of safety and shift into a sense of safety. And that's like the, you know, holding space in that moment for her to heal.
Yeah, I mean, I think my willingness to receive both sides of herself and not judge either one, you know, and even to the point of, because a lot of, you know, I think a lot of therapists would have, you know, maybe dissuaded her from, you know, that part of her that is super verbal, cognitive, executive, charging off and starting something, you know. But my feeling was that she had to actually go through this process of trying to live that part of herself and just seeing that it really, she couldn't do it anymore. That there wasn't, I think without the motivation of taking care of her son, there wasn't a center that would hold her together through these kinds of, through that kind of fragmented self. So, yeah, I think that being able to kind of really just give her the full bandwidth without saying, well, you know, you really need to get a job or you really need to, you know, I guess we should really put you on some medication because you're not, you know, you're not improving quickly enough. And again, I mean, maybe that was the wrong take. I mean, it's the one that she wanted. She didn't want to take that path. She wanted to take the path of really exploring. And she got to the, you know, she's really getting to the bottom of some very powerful trauma and being able to witness and piece together or bring together into a closer oscillation these two parts of herself, you know, which I don't think, you know, a conventional treatment would have allowed her to do. So that, you know, my trusting her ability that she's really not gonna, you know, she's not crazy, that she's just experiencing the fragmentation of trauma and that through a sense of caring, safe connection, that she could gradually feel safe enough to get to the bottom of it, which is the powerful abandonment, shame, and you know, that she felt. Any other thoughts about that case or?
Mary?
Oh, go ahead.
Chihui? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. From the presentation, I feel that it's actually sounds quite in the form of a traditional psychotherapy sort of session. As in, like, you know, you're giving the space and, you know, like, letting patients sort of like work with his the past. So I can't really see how what we have been talking about in terms of using some of the what we have learned in the class in terms of in the session itself. I mean, you can use the languaging as in the perspective of seeing the process in terms of giving her the space and things like that. But I feel that the whole process is still very based on the traditional sort of psychotherapy sort of approach. Yeah, you know, the process may be the same, but it seems like it's just how you view it using sort of like different concept or different understanding about the process. But in terms of actually using the what we have practiced in the, what we have learned in the class, it doesn't sort of like come out through your presentation.
Yeah,
I don't really see it. Yeah.
Fair enough. I think that, you know, we've certainly, this is a case where I've used, because of the way her mind works, we've sort of used the language of psychotherapy to help describe her experience. But I think within the deeper, you know, both in terms of my having faith and trust in her and being able to show her a level of unconditional acceptance, that I certainly believe that that capacity is really based on my fundamental, you know, my practice and my ability to trust in the my own deeper natural healing capacity, and to stay connected to her through a lot of extreme behaviors that I think might have otherwise been labeled or diagnosed. Now, could a good, you know, intersubjective therapist or you know, conventional dynamic therapist have done something very similar with this therapy? Perhaps, yeah. You know, I do think that, you know, she does have a practice. She does have a contemplative practice. She's used a lot of self-compassion work as part of it. I mean, I didn't sort of highlight that because, you know, I think I didn't, you know, that was on her own that she's studied those practices. But I think the deeper issue here is really in terms of her, you know, coming to feel that, you know, she has the inner, you know, spiritual capacity, you know, natural awareness, whatever, that deeper capacity to hold her own suffering. I think she's certainly seen it as part of a path of spiritual integration. And so, yeah, I think I take your comment, Chiwe. I think it's true that, you know, it's not like, you know, I spent every session leading her through a compassion meditation. You know, at the same time, I really feel like, you know, I don't think that my Western training would have really allowed me to stay with her and go to, you know, keep my heart as open to her and be as transparent to her as if I hadn't had this sort of larger sense of really being ready to kind of be in this existential moment with this person, this kind of deeper, you know, this person is on a life path and is doing her own healing. And I'm just kind of there with her as a guide or a companion. So, but I think it's a fair, you know, comment. Yeah,
thank you.
Roseanne.
Well, what you just said, Joe, about it just made me think about early on, you said you could just be a bozo on the bus, and I don't think that's true. I think that the relationship and your own practices from how you've been talking, you know, whether it's that compassion for yourself, your trust in the process, your trust in her, like you said, but I think your trust in yourself and the practices, whether it's bringing compassion to yourself, not abandoning yourself, equanimity, you know, in the face of some pretty, you know, what she's bringing to you, more than bringing, you know. and I just keep thinking about her mother's inability to tolerate intense emotions and locking her in a room. And not only have you come alongside her, even when she has very intense emotions and these fragmented self states, but you've come alongside yourself as well. So as I'm thinking about what you've been sharing and teaching us, you know, that these, you know, many of these practices are helping us to be able to stay with. And to be able to do, I mean, if I can think about it from a Cohutian perspective, but I really feel like it is spiritual as well. So you can be there and you can mirror and she can feel seen and heard and be able to really feel that herself and come to know what she's feeling. But in addition, I think that, you know, she is seeing you also as a mentor and being able to, you know, idealize you and be able to internalize, you know, that transmuting internalization is important. I mean, I see the integration, or I'm hearing it. I don't want to say I'm seeing it. I'm hearing it in how you're sharing your capacity to stay with her.
Yeah, thank you, Rosanna. I mean, I certainly think, when I think about my training, I do not think I would have, you know, had the confidence, the courage, the conviction, the patience to treat her the way I've treated her. I think it is based on some, you know, a willingness to just, you know, to believe that you know, people can heal themselves if we really try and hold that process with them and for them. And that's coming from a trust in our, you know, that we're bigger than our pathology, basically, that, you know, that there's a, you know, a deeper, positivity and awareness that will shine through if we can just hang in there long enough. But thank you for that. So I'm not sure if we only have a few minutes left. Maybe I'll just share with you some of the outlines for the couples, my approach to couples work, which again, you know, I said this again when Seso Paul visited, he and I are very similar in this, that I really feel like the way that these practices have the biggest impact is not by being techniques, but it's by changing your way of being. And however subtle that is, you know, I do think it makes a real difference. So let me just share a little bit the work, the kind of way I approach couples work. So again, this is all too dense, but I would just say, you know, the key thing here is that I really believe that the experience of closeness comes from the ability to share, right? And that when we can't share emotionally, we feel this sense of blockage or distance in our connection. And so unfortunately, and you know, that's the basis of that is a capacity, each person's capacity for empathy and compassion for their partner. And of course themselves. And the problem is, of course, that we can't have access to empathy and compassion when we don't feel safe, right? And, you know, as a result, and as we know, whenever stress and trauma kick in, we don't feel safe, and hence we're in a different part of our system. So the key element here, what I see in working with couples is how the inability to work through difficult emotional conversations triggers this attachment stress and trauma, and then blocks off the capacity for empathy that's really needed, right? And then I really try to help people understand, you know, that there's no shortcut to intimacy, that everyone has to really, each person has to learn to own their own traumas, heal their own traumas, stop projecting them or reenacting them, and to do that through self-awareness and self-compassion, and then, you know, that capacity to do a little better managing your own trauma will allow you to really repair when you're disconnected, rather than get triggered into trauma and reactivity. And so when couples can really move through those, can share both good and bad while maintaining that sense of empathy and compassion, that's when you have the sort of the strong force of relationship or intimacy takes place. So how does this look like? You know, in the evolution of my work with people, usually we start at the problem isn't me, it's my partner, right? And which is the blame position. You remember, and you know, maybe eventually people will get to the place where it's not me or my partner, but our relationship, but that's still an externalizing blame position. So when we start to look at the sort of specifics of how we get stuck in relationship, you know, the problem now becomes the trauma patterns or habits that we get stuck in. And again, I try to work with people to then take responsibility for their own part, because first we want to experience the other as the one who's traumatized, not me. Like, you're so reactive. And when we get to the next stage or evolution in this point, we're looking at understanding that the problem is my trauma and my partner's, right? That we both have this vulnerability and capacity, and we both had to learn how to survive that childhood trauma, but in surviving, we can't access compassion, right? So we need to have, you know, cues of safe connection. We need to have help from we feel we need the partner to be more helpful, loving, accepting, and caring. And again, that's another, you know, projection of responsibility. And when we realize that we need to be able to give ourselves and our partners those cues of safe connection is when we really start to be able to transition into being able to actually sustain. And you can see where self-compassion is so important here as the critical variable to opening the capacity for empathy and compassion for a partner. So hold on, let me out of this. I don't know if anyone has any thoughts about that framework, but the basic idea here is that we, just as we need to be able to stay, you know, in a caring relationship to ourselves, it becomes that much more difficult when we're intimate with another person. And this, the skill of being able to bring compassion to how we get triggered in the interaction is like the rate limiting step in our ability to stay connected. And this process, I will often talk to people about the, you know, I won't say drive all blame into one, but I will talk to people about the way in which they're projecting their demon narratives onto their partner. They're projecting blame for their emotional traumas onto their partner, and they really need to take responsibility for their own traumas and learn how to face and heal them. And that typically has to do with, learning to break through the, you know, negative, the core shame beliefs or the negative beliefs that we have about ourselves that embed or anchor trauma, and to really learn how to, bring that deeper sense of, self-acceptance, that allows us to, not just survive, but to sort of break out of our assuming the worst about ourselves and assuming the worst about relationships. So again, I'm sorry that this couples part is a little rushed. Perhaps we can have some other time to come back to it. And I was going to share with you a case, but we certainly don't have time, so I'm not gonna try. But if anyone has any questions or thoughts about how focusing on the importance of compassion as or empathy as the force that has to be accessed, I think in both my work with individuals and with couples, really trying to not stay on the surface of who said what to whom, or who's right or who's wrong, or who's crazy or who's not crazy, really trying to help them understand that they need to really go much deeper in terms of their ability to bear their own suffering. And that applies doubly when you're with a partner, because in your relationship, you're exposed not just to your own suffering, but you're exposed to your partner's as well. So you kind of need a double dose of compassion in order to be able to hold all the suffering that gets bounced around between you and the other person. So just trusting that people can actually do this, that we don't need to kind of dilute that journey down and just say, well, if you can just negotiate around this glitch, or compromise around that glitch, then somehow you're going to be able to live a happy life. But of course, the happiness in intimacy is being able to be in a place of love and compassion with our partners. And so if we don't deal with how, you know, attachment trauma or the threat of disconnection or miscommunication triggers us, we're going to be bouncing back and forth from feeling connected to feeling disconnected forever. Again, we have a few minutes. Maybe it will just be more helpful for us to reflect together if anyone has any reflections on how compassion work might apply to couples.
Well, Joe, there was a good question that I think might put a bow on things, because someone wrote a question asking if you could speak briefly to how you use your practice, your personal practice, to anchor yourself in safety and integration when you're working with people with these complex histories, or, you know, that present with very complex situations like this. And how does that compare and contrast to your medical training and how it suggested perhaps how you'd accomplish that same safety and integration?
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, my experience of my medical training was that that the only safety was in, you know, labeling and controlling. And that, you know, basically we're coming from a defensive position from the very get-go. Trusting in humanity, trusting in the power of healing is the opposite of where I was trained to come from. I think that's less true in psychotherapy training and my psychoanalytic type training, where there's a deeper sense of, you know, the organic or, you know, natural process of healing. But I would say how the practice has really helped me more than any other way is just that, you know, the whatever start I got in my self-healing in my own analysis, or in my, I had a second therapy, you know, that I've been able to continue healing through my practice. That I've been able to continue to sort of keep facing my own traumatic reactivity or my sort of negative relationship with myself or my own fears about abandonment or rejection, and to keep going deeper and dissolving them more and tapping into more and more trusting the happy mind, you know, the mind where I can actually feel safe and connected to you know, myself, and hence trust that others can as well. I mean, I do think this is the wellspring of how, you know, I've often, people often say to me, you know, how do you get through the day and how do you handle so much? And I think, you know, part of where I feel like, you know, I've gotten with my practice is that I really have a fundamental sense that, you know, that this stuff works, that deep healing is possible. And it's ultimately through my ability to continue my analysis and my psychotherapy through this deeper practice. And you know, to have a sense that there's no glass ceiling, there's no, limit to how much healing we can do if we keep, using, deep awareness, compassion for ourselves and others, the skills of being able to shift our own, default states, our own default, you know, suffering states into states of well-being and safety, and where we're open to connecting with others. So, I do find that, you know, I really enjoy my work with others. I don't experience it as work. I experience it as connecting with friends and following a story of someone's life that I deeply care for. And I think this, just feeds me and gives me a deep sense of satisfaction in my work. And I don't think I would have been able to do that without the extra help breaking apart some of my own insecurities and performance anxieties and issues about, whether I'd be judged, criticized, or whether I'd please people or not. I really think, you know, I feel much more grounded in my work, and I continue to feel more grounded in it as my practice deepens. So, you know, I don't know, we have maybe a minute left if anyone has any final thoughts.
I just want to share the transformative nature of the practices, like even the sutra practices, transforming the mind, and also the imagery and the role modeling imagery and, you know, perfection stage practices. They all seem to create a transformative shift inside of us. And so even situations that we think that we don't not up to the task for, right? Now all of a sudden an opening gets created, you know, where there's, you know, aversion comes from a sense of, I can't do that. That's not something I can do, right? And so once that is worked with and transformed, we can. You can make space for your client to, you know, say honest things from her heart to you on a text message, right? So like, you know, you have that space to have that confidence, receive that in a way where, you know, it's not going to eat at you because of those transformative practices. It's that was just something that just struck me as how those practices work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the capacity to sort of really, you know, be more transparent and not feel I have to anything to prove or defend, you know, it takes a lot of the stress out of trying to be there for people. And also really ultimately my confidence that people have really endless capacity to heal themselves. And yeah, I think this is, to go back to Chiwei's point, it would be nice if I could break this down into steps and principles that were easier to cookbook. But that hasn't been my experience. You know, my experience is that my practice has been a kind of deep grounding, humanizing, healing path that has made me an infinitely better therapist and helped me do this work and be more joyful and effective in it. And I don't know that there's a shortcut. I do think, you know, and teaching people how to do their own, how to practice themselves is the next best thing, because I think when your clients start to get interested and, you know, want some of what you're having and to do some practice themselves, then I think you know you've got two minds working toward deeper healing, and that's certainly a very powerful extra charge or extra force for healing. So anyway, I hope we'll come back and maybe I'll find some other time to come back and share the couple's case with you and see if we can look back at the, you know, in more detail how I see that and how I work with couples. But thanks again for your time and your.
We want to hear the couple's case.
Yeah, well, it's couples are always more dramatic. All right, I promise we'll find some time sometime. Okay, all right, take care, all.